VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and welcome to the Game Podcast, here for another review of the weekend's events. And it was a sobering weekend as well. Later on, we'll be discussing Fabrice Muamba and the traumatic events at White Hart Lane. But first, Liverpool and Stoke in the FA Cup. I want to start with you, Dicko, because Stuart Downing scored, finally. And not just once, but twice. How about that?
How about that? I was just thinking. I mean, I don't know what you thought of the little 1-2 with Gerrard. Looked slightly accidental, but that shouldn't take away from a nice, very nice finish. I mean, Downing's he's a strange one. When he was first playing internationally, he looked completely out of his depth. And I spoke to a few people, and they said that he was one of the classic guys who was afraid of the shirt, and that raised questions about his sort of big game temperament. I thought that Liverpool were taking a bit of a punt with him. The evidence since then has been pretty mixed. I mean, he went through a long period lacking in confidence. And yet, bizarrely, has actually started playing a bit better in an England shirt, a bit more confidently. So there's a pretty mixed bag of evidence to sift through there. And, I personally think he's a highly competent Premiership player and an England squad member at best. But, you know, a decent positive sign yesterday, that's for sure.
Lansley, you saw him up close for quite a while.
Yeah, he had a great second season. First season when he was coming back from his, I think he had a broken ankle, didn't he? And he didn't really get flowing. But after he'd had a full pre-season, that second season when Villa were just on the wane, but still had Ashley Young and him, he had a fantastic season. He worked so hard. And I agree with Matt, because in a team that was just, you know, battling to try and get, you know, somewhere between 6th and 10th, he was excellent. But but possibly not when you go onto the international stage.
Well, forget the international stage, Ben. They keep talking about this international stage thing because, of course, Dicko and Lansley are big England fans. But if Tony Evans were here, he wouldn't care about that. He just want to know, is he good enough for Liverpool?
Until the last few months, I don't think he has been good enough for Liverpool.
But now he plays a good game and you change your mind.
No, hold on. He hadn't created or scored a goal until very recently. He started to show signs after Christmas that he was finding his feet. Played pretty well in the Carling Cup final. And since then, it's started to look a lot more confident. And, you know, he has the natural attributes, I think. He's surprisingly quick. He can deliver a good cross. And
he's surprisingly quick for a slow player.
Yeah, but that's it. You know, he's not Walcott, but he can surprise defenders. And I think he's starting to look like he might be, you know, not justifying that price tag, but certainly going some way towards it.
Adam Johnson should be a better footballer. And to be honest, I think Mancini's clearly been frustrated by him and his application. But I look at what Adam Johnson should have, and I see a considerably better football player than Stuart Downing. But equally, you know, consistency of delivery is as important as talent.
But Matt, isn't Adam Johnson just a very good beach player? I mean, he knows how to, you know, beating people and
a beach player. Is that what you said, Lansley?
Yeah.
As in, like, playing on the beach?
Yeah. Have you not heard that phrase?
Not from somebody in the Midlands. I didn't know there were any beaches there. Seriously, do you guys play in the beaches on this country?
Carsington Water, we've got a lot of sand on the edges there. We've had quite a big drought. But, I think it, Adam Johnson, I'm not sure, in top class terms, that he is better than someone who's very good at dribbling and cutting inside and looking for a shot. I think he plays for himself too much.
Okay, let's move this on from the Johnson-Downing debate. Or we could expand it out to James Morrison and just maintain the discussion of Middlesbrough-produced wingers. But and we'll get to Dalglish and Stoke in a minute. I just want to just jump in on something Luis Suarez said, where he said that he's going to stay at Liverpool despite suffering. Now, is this something where we in the childish media take his statement entirely out of context and mock him, and how much suffering could you be doing with your money and blah blah blah, and you're kind of responsible for your own lot in life because you could have just said nothing at all to Patrice Evra and then none of this would have happened, and you could have not given the finger to Fulham fans? Or do you have any sympathy for his suffering, Ben?
Suffering and probably not suffering. I think from his point of view, he still feels, as many inside Liverpool do, that he did nothing wrong. We know that. Now, as a player, I think for the rights or wrongs of that, which everyone knows my view on that, I think that he has been obviously made to feel very loved, whether that's right or wrong, he has. And Liverpool have all along said there is no intention there for them to sell this player. And clearly Suarez has felt that, you know, a debt of loyalty and gratitude for the way he has been treated. You know, outside of Liverpool, that's a very different situation. But I think for now, he is staying. And I think if he can get back to playing the game, you know, and concentrating on football and keeping his mouth shut and behaving and doing what he does best, then we're in for a treat. If he can't, then...
Don't you find it staggering? I mean, you know, as journalists, we want people to gas off all the time about all sorts of things, and especially the controversial things. But I just find it staggering that Liverpool have not basically put a blanket ban on anyone even straying near this territory. I mean, Glenn Johnson did that interview in a paper I can't bring myself to mention recently, but a very fine interview it was. But I was staggered that, you know, he was just, you know, talking freely and ridiculously defensively and provocatively about that whole subject again. Here we have Suarez straying into that territory again. I'm just amazed that, you know, there's not a memo gone out around Anfield just basically saying the next employee talks about this will be fired.
You find it staggering, but I mean, if the club's line is that, and they genuinely...
Well, no, because the club's... I thought we'd just about reached the point where the club accepted that they were not going to, you know, whatever stance whatever trench they had dug for themselves, that they were not going to persuade anyone else out there that had already decided that they were in the wrong and that Suarez was in the wrong, that they would have just come to the practical PR decision that they were not only wasting their breath, but just continuing to antagonise.
But one thing we should say is the club didn't know about the Johnson interview. That was done without their permission. It was done while he was on England duty, I believe. And the latest Suarez comments have come from a newspaper in Montevideo, I think.
El País, yes.
Right, so... I agree. I think they should be telling everyone.
Let's just not talk about it. Well, that's one way to handle it.
No. Told him, chaps. Haven't they almost told Suarez he's beyond the law because of how much they've defended him? And, you know, they've even after the 8-game ban, it took so long for anything approaching a genuine apology to come out, that they've told him everything you've done is okay. Therefore, if he's away in Uruguay and he wants to give a newspaper interview, he knows he's safe.
Well, but, you know, it's also... I mean, I take your point, and obviously we don't want to go and rehash this issue, because otherwise we'll never get out of it. But I think Dicko made a good point about the club PR perspective. By the same token, you know, a club is not a cult, even though Liverpool sometimes feels that way. They're employers, and you can kind of see how Luis Suarez... speaking to people from his own country, where I think a lot of people have interpreted this situation very differently, you know, might want to speak his mind freely. In the same way Glenn Johnson, speaking to a journalist he's particularly close to, you know, might want to come out and do that. And that, you know, you could make the point that even within Liverpool, this is our official club line. We don't really want people to talk about it, but we're not going to treat you like children. I mean,
if you're treating footballers like children, some of them need it. But it's not the hugest deal. I just, you know, every week and I open a paper and see a Liverpool player talking about Suarez, I just think, you know, is someone there not, and PR, you know, PR is not the most important thing in the world, but, you know, it matters, it plays a little part. And if I were Liverpool and at the top of that organisation, I would be sending out some pretty stiff memos saying, you know, let's move on.
Well, let's move on to somebody who is at or near the top of the Liverpool organisation. That's Kenny Dalglish. You know, if I may digress into my own experience this weekend, I had a rather curious Twitter experience where I sort of went all Bill Edgar, and I was curious to see how Dalglish had done compared to previous Liverpool managers, most of whom I think have, you know, ranged from the terrible to the well above average, perhaps. And I just looked at the number of wins, draws, and losses, and points accrued in their first 44 matches in charge as manager, because Dalglish has been in charge for 44 league games, the first 44 league games, plus two where he was interim manager. And what I found out is that, bizarrely, he actually has a higher points total than any of the guys before him. So Rafa Benitez, Gerard Houllier, Graham Souness, and Roy Evans. The last guy to do better than Dalglish was Dalglish the first time around. And you weighed that up, against the League Cup, and possibly now they're in good position, I think, now in the FA Cup. And this caused a whole storm on Twitter with, you know, the Dalglish haters saying, like, oh, why are you sucking up to him and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm not. These are just numbers, right? We can go and debate his spending and whatever else. But based on the results, and leaving the spending aside for a second, and I think the spending hasn't been great, are you on board with that, Dicko, that, you know, he's actually pretty good at coaching the team and getting results? Or Because people say, like, oh, look, but he spent all this money. Yeah, but you would argue that the guys he bought aren't what have made Liverpool good this season. It's, in fact, apart from Suarez and maybe Jose Enrique, they've all been pretty pish.
Well, there was an upswing caused by a few things, wasn't there? I mean, in the same way that, you know, clearly a different situation from Dimitri, but there was just the bounce from getting rid of Hodgson, from the whole, you know, unifying experience, which, you know, these things seem to be sort of an even more powerful force at somewhere like Liverpool and somewhere like Anfield than anywhere else, is coming out of Hicks Gillette. So there was just, you know, Dalglish was this messianic appointment, and that part of it, you know, undoubtedly sort of, you know, was a sort of powerful wave that, you know, doesn't fix everything, but certainly fixed an awful lot of things.
I think You have to say that the club's in a far better position than it was when Roy Hodgson was there. You know, I think a few results here and there at home this season, you look at the home record, it's appalling, and there's huge room for improvement there. I don't think there's a huge amount to be done to improve that. But if they were to have turned three or four of those draws into victories, then we'd be talking about an extremely good season here. They'd be round about fourth, possibly even third, you know, into an FA Cup semi-final, one trophy in the bag. That's a really, really good season. This is a decent season.
But I think that, you know, mistakes have been, you know, and so generally it's a sort of, you know, I don't know, seven out of ten. If they win two cups, you start lifting it. But, you know, there have been some slightly erratic team selections, I thought, at different times. Back threes picked when I couldn't quite understand it. Issues with attack and fluency. And as Gab said, some of the signings have definitely not proved anything like value for money yet. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a genuinely upwardly mobile story. There's no two ways about that.
Of course, we could just blame all the bad signings on Damien Comolli, but we won't, because we know better. Lansley, I want to just get you on Stoke, because it's another season where, you know, I think they've had mid-table tranquility, despite obviously the Europa League taking something out of them, although I think they do have a pretty big squad. I noticed something interesting. I was just looking at their unused subs against Liverpool, and it's Kenwyn Jones, Matthew Upson, and Wilson Palacios, who I was thinking out loud of how much Kenwyn Jones cost, how much Palacios cost Spurs when they originally signed him, and obviously Upson, who was starting center half for England in a couple World Cup games. Is this a sign that they've got tremendous depth, or that maybe sometimes Tony Pulis actually does better with when he spends less money and targets his players than when he goes for like bigger names?
I think it's taken Pulis a hell of a lot of handling this season, but I think they're going to come out of it with a great deal of credit. There is that added depth to the squad, and with that has come the man management challenge of keeping people happy, because I think Pulis, a bit like some other managers I could think of, he likes to have a pretty regular starting 11 or 13 or whatever. So if he can keep Jermaine Pennant happy when he's in and out of the team, if he can keep Matthew Upson happy, that's going to be a continued challenge for him. But here's another cup quarter final. They've had a really good Europa League run, that's lifted everything about them. The crowds are fantastic at Stoke. I don't know when you guys have last had the chance to go to the Britannia, but they are just so up nearly all the time. They're still really appreciating what they've got there. So if they can come out of this season, they will avoid qualifying for Europe now, of course. Then, you could really see them pushing for somewhere between 6th and 10th next season. They could be the new Aston Villa.
All right, let's move on to Molyneux, which I know will make Lansley very happy. But let's start with the bad news first. I watched those pictures on TV. I guess it was after the last game, of all the angry Wolves fans saying, Morgan, show your face, blah, blah, blah. Can you explain, are they angry because Mick is gone? Are they angry because they didn't appoint the guy they wanted? Are they angry because they don't like Terry Connor? And all these people said that Terry Connor was actually, after I guess he did well in his first game, said, but he's really clever and he's very good and continuity and all this jazz. What do the fans want Morgan to do?
Well, they wanted him to have a plan B, Gab, basically. When if McCarthy's time was up, and there's a debate to be had, then they wanted to know that in that fortnight's international break, or fortnight without a game for Wolves, that he knew what he was doing. And so when, I'm afraid, a knee-jerk reaction, and if you've just lost 5-1 at home to West Bromwich Albion, your nearest, fiercest rivals, then you're entitled to...
It's understandable, yeah.
You can jerk the odd knee. But if you're going to... I'm sorry, it's a business, isn't it? You sound people out. There were people out there who, whether you rate them or not, were not employed by the clubs. You wouldn't have been doing anything unethical to go and chat things through with them. Look, guys, what do you think? Take it to the end of the season.
You're talking about Kurt, but it's the penalties. Those people were Kurbishley and Bruce. So you can see why... if you go in with those people and one of them wants like a 12-year contract and the other one wants £2 million a year after screwing up Sunderland, maybe he said, I am playing devil's advocate here, but what is so wrong for Morgan to do what Chelsea did with Robbie Di Matteo and say, hey, here's a guy who's a clever assistant. Mick McCarthy's gone, but we're looking really for a bounce. We don't want a total overhaul now. If Connor stinks and we go down, then I ditch him at the end of the season. It's not going to cost me too much. And then maybe in the summer there'll be more and better players and better managers available rather than having to turn to these guys who are out of work for a reason.
I think when you mention the word cost there, I think that would... And rightly so, it might be cheaper to have these changes, then that does rile Wolves fans. And they're thinking, if you're doing this because you're doing it on the cheap, then for goodness sake, how hard was it getting back into the Premiership to go and throw it away?
Well, it might be quite expensive to go down as well. I mean, if you're thinking of saving money, then, going down isn't probably the way to do it, I think. I mean, it's been a balls up from the start. I just think, you look at it now and you think, who would do a better job of keeping Wolves up? Would it be Mick McCarthy or his assistant Terry Connor? I think there's an easy answer to be made there. I thought that at the time. I thought,
we're not Wolves players, right? So we're not at training.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And we don't know what Mick McCarthy does and what Terry Connor does.
Yeah.
So we have a situation. We can judge Mick McCarthy's body of work, his games and so on.
Yeah.
But we can't judge what you know, I would presume Morgan was there, was watching them train, and said like, "Oh, look, Connor's doing all these wonderful things." And
I think I think knowing the little I do about Steve Morgan, I think that's very unlikely. I think this was an emotional decision based on a couple of weeks of runs, and although a lot of people were saying get him out after this 5-1 thing, there was a you know, we had a debate at the time, and Pete, you said they need a new voice. So who do you bring in? You bring the guy who you hear on the training ground for the last 6 months. Is that a new voice? No, and this doesn't surprise me. Unfortunately, Morgan deserves what he's got, as far as I'm concerned.
And Gab, the other thing is, Mick McCarthy for 5 years has got an average bunch of players just to go and perform at the old 110%. So if you're going to get another guy in, for example, if you'd got Kerbishley in, who was Morgan's favourite from day one, probably, despite the, you know, years out of the game, was probably the most appropriate one of who was available, would he have managed to get Stephen Ward to run the 15 kilometres a game and to, you know, put heart and soul into the blocks and everything? I don't think so.
You bring in Stephen Ward, is it so difficult to persuade him? I mean, we're talking about Stephen Ward here. We're not talking about Riquelme or Gaza, right? Is it so hard to go and tell him, hey, Stephen Ward, you're really not that good. If you want to start for me and contribute, you have to run 15K a game.
It sounds like the Tony Evans School of Management. If you telling him he's not that good, then...
But you know what I'm saying? Like, you bring up Stephen Ward. Is it really that difficult to get Stephen Ward to perform?
No. Gab, we're being simplistic here. It's talking about getting the team unit of average players to overperform.
And are they that average when you look at the money that they've spent and the quality of the squad? I mean, they added O'Hara and Johnson this summer. I know O'Hara's been injured and Johnson's been bad, but or not as good as they thought he was. But if you look the last couple of years, it's not like they've been the lowest spenders and had the lowest wage bill in the Premier League, is it?
No, it isn't. And they spent $18 million the summer before last. But what does that buy you? That's half your Premiership money per season nowadays. So that's not such a... Premiership terms, I say, Wolves have got an average set of players. And Wolves fans would be proud to say that. It'd be great. And they'd be delighted if Wolves were 10th. But McCarthy got them overachieving. It isn't easy to do that, to get that cohesiveness from a team.
And considering you've done that pretty consistently, I mean, the thing that shocked me was how quickly into the season the fans turned. I mean, you know, as Pete says, when you start losing 5-1 at home to West Brom, you know, you can understand a certain degree of fan angst. But actually, they were booing when things were not looking that bad early in the season. When, you know, there was clearly a bad start, but, you know, this is a guy who'd done a pretty solid job for the club. And as I say, I just thought the fans turned on him far too quickly, and that must have got Morgan jumpy, and it sort of unravelled from there. But I thought those fans who were turning on Mick, you know, we're talking months and months ago, I think should be feeling pretty stupid, to be honest.
All right, let's talk to Manchester United now, because of course there's a lot of United fans out there, as we're often reminded. To me, it looked like they didn't really break a sweat in this game, obviously helped by Zubar's sending off. But I kind of feel that had he been on the pitch, it really wouldn't have changed so much. My impression here, Dicko, is that when United win big, we need to find a reason why. And people are like, oh, look, Valencia's back. Oh, how key it is for him to be back. Now, Valencia's a very good player, but I kind of feel that I thought there were two key players for United this season, Rooney and Vidic, and it shows you what I know, because Vidic gets hurt and they don't really miss a beat, at least domestically. Is Valencia key, or is he just another option for a manager who's got a tremendous amount of options and likes to mix and match and interchange? And really, you know, he just gives you a slightly different dimension, but it's not like he's going to go out and start every single game now.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't judge on just on yesterday, because that was flattering. I mean, you or I could have looked pretty classy against some of that Wolves defense.
Well, thank you.
I could have anyway. But no, I have to say that I think Valencia's been excellent.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
In pretty much most of the games I've seen him in since he's come back, and I think he's... you know, he's actually sort of, there have been times when he thought, wow, you know, what an absence he was, and you know, the versatility, he's been dropping back to right back as well at times. I wasn't actually sure when Fergie first bought him whether he was worth the money, and I think he's proved he is. I think, you know, was 9 out of 10 against Wolves flattering? Yes, but is he a very good player and very important for United? Certainly, and I think he's got a consistent. He's, you know, we talked earlier about consistency of performance. He's got it at the moment.
All right. So if he's, well, would you say he's an automatic choice, a la Rooney?
On the games I've seen this season, he's in terms of winning. So, he's because Young. I mean, Young now is back as well. I mean, they strike me as the obvious balance at the moment. In certain, you know, Young had that, you know, went on for 2 or 3 months where he seemed to just sort of lose his way a bit, but he seems to be coming back.
Because Ben, this is what I find fascinating about United, is that when so many people talk about settled lineups and chemistry and whatever, and I've gone about this about Ferguson, is that, you know, he's just such a dominating figure that we forget little details that really make him different and perhaps special. And one of them is they really don't have a settled lineup. He mixes and matches. And if you're going to say Valencia is an automatic choice, and I assume you would consider Rooney as an automatic choice, and probably right now Carrick is an automatic choice, there aren't that many other places to go around. And, you know, is it Chicharito or is it Welbeck? Is it Young or Nani, who will be back at some point, or Park, or, you know, Scholes when he's there, but maybe he doesn't play every week? It's pretty remarkable and pretty unlike everybody else.
He is brilliant at it, at balancing, at rotating his squad in such a way that it doesn't feel like he's a tinker man. It's never been something he's labelled with, but he does it brilliantly, and he keeps the players happy. Everyone knows they'll get a chance, and when they do, they have to impress, otherwise the likelihood is they'll go. And even if they do impress, they may well find themselves on the bench the next game. He has done it consistently over the years better than any other manager. He knows when to play a player and when to drop them and when to leave them out and when to give them a go. And he more than ever this season has been a huge, huge factor behind why United are where they are. I mean, I just can't believe any other manager would have taken a squad that hasn't really played anywhere near its best all season and kept it right in there. Not just kept it right in there, but overhauled a club that was flying like City. Fair enough, they're not anymore. But
he's
fantastic.
The central midfield is still the issue that we keep coming.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I got bombarded on Twitter recently when talking about England options, and Carrick didn't get a mention. I mean, I wouldn't have Carrick in my England squad for the Euros, and yet, you know, an awful lot of Man U fans think he should be, you know, one of the players of the season. You know, not just for them, but across the whole bloody country. So, Carrick will continue to divide and polarise, and, you know, if he ends up with yet another league championship medal, then that will be held up as evidence of, you know, what a fantastic and overlooked player he is. But I'm afraid I'm, you know, not a fan. To think he's overrun far too easily. Think he plays great in games like, you know, when you're 5-0 up against Wolves. Can't stem or turn the tide in other games. Looks, you know, and doesn't look enough to make the quick, incisive, decisive pass. So, but, you know, Carrick is still at the heart of a team that does not have a good enough central midfield.
And perhaps that'll be something that they'll look to address in the summer. Moving on now to this week, I think we all witnessed some awful events at White Hart Lane. Those of us, most were there, some of us were watching on television. Fabrice Muamba, towards the end of the first half, collapsing onto the pitch. The paramedics came on right now, according to the most recent reports that we have, and we are recording this mid-morning Monday. He's in critical but stable condition at the London Chest Hospital, and it does appear as if he had a cardiac arrest and his heart actually stopped for an extended period of time. There's been a lot of speculation, and I think a lot of generalizations as well, of people tying together different incidents and stuff, which I personally think is a little bit inappropriate when we don't actually know exactly what happened in this incident. But I'm interested in the immediate reaction. I kind of think that this really resonated with a lot of people. And Tico, I want to start with you. You know, there were the tweets from players and fans, the situation, the reaction from the crowd. Is there a glimmer of encouragement in, you know, amidst this, obviously, this tragic event? Can you take some positives?
I think everyone, the pictures of the spectators at White Hart Lane, you know, the shock and the upset on their faces, and, you know, for those of us who weren't there, they were incredibly revealing, and, you know, clearly, you know, fans quickly sense when something is, you know, I mean, you know, football can be an awful place where, you know, people sing horrible songs that guys have been carried off with broken legs. That is known. In this instance, thankfully, people realised the seriousness of it pretty quickly and reacted appropriately. I think there's an awful lot of very touching words that have been written this morning about, you know, how football has responded and recognised this, you know, awful situation. You know, the last thing you expect from a incredibly fit and incredibly healthy and pretty popular footballer. But you know, will it change anything from next week? We have to sadly question that. You know, it's everyone is united at this moment, but you know, how long before we get back to horrible chants about dead chairman that we had at Derby v Nottingham Forest?
So Lansley, we shouldn't take this as like a civilizing moment necessarily for our crowds, but you know, perhaps simply accept that this was something which for whatever reason really resonated with people who didn't know him, people maybe wouldn't have cared about him otherwise, but we're all united in the hope that he's going to pull through this.
Yeah, the reaction was kind of edifying to witness, I understand, but I think it probably helped that the two clubs were from opposite ends of the country, if that's not too cynical, because as Tico said, you know, Derby Forest last week, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, all of us on this podcast will have had someone close and die in the last year or two.
Can you just tell us what they were, what it was about?
Yeah, and Sean Barker, the Derby captain, there was a four-minute delay while he dislocated his knee and might be out for 9 months. And at that moment, the Derby fans, 74th minute, so they hadn't done anything to do with the Forest chairman, the Forest owner who passed away last month, suddenly burst into, "Where's your chairman gone? You're going down with your chairman. You got what you wanted. You wanted him out." And I've got friends who standing over, who sit over in that area, and I just cannot believe it. And after it had happened once, you thought, surely a reality check will kick in, and, you know, their mates will just have a word about dignity. But no, it went on, and it was absolutely disgraceful. And it does, doesn't it? And it's because the clubs are 14 miles apart, and we see it in Leeds and Manchester, and Leeds fans at Derby aren't always very nice about Brian Clough and things like that. So I think when there is that sort of tribal element between clubs, it brings out the very, very worst in football fans. A minority of them.
I think what Saturday did was remind everyone that football pales into insignificance when something like this happens, when people's lives are on the line. It really isn't as important as life or death. It really, really isn't. And I think people snap out of what they're involved in and realise exactly what matters in life. And I think that's what's brought football together. I think they realise that they are, you know, they're there for fun, for entertainment. But when something as serious as this happens, they're there. They're one. They're you know, it's a cliche. It's the football family. It comes together, and nothing really matters other than Fabrice Muamba to them at the moment. And that was wonderful to see. And you would hope somewhere along the line that this would give people some perspective when they're at, you know, when there's Liverpool, Manchester United fans chanting things at each other, and you would think it somewhere along the line it would resonate and people would remember what's happened here. But as Dicko said, you fear that it gets forgotten all too quickly.
You obviously don't buy into the whole catharsis argument that some people have said, that when Liverpool and United fans, for example, chant those things at each other, and we all know what they are, it's actually just part of the spectacle. But if a bunch of Liverpool fans saw a United player or a United fan collapse in that way, they would be the first, or the other way around, obviously, they would be the first to actually help and show empathy. But the reality is they don't think of the same way about events that happened, and tragic events that happened years ago.
I think you're right. I think this had happened at a Liverpool-Manchester United game, I think we would have seen the same reaction. I pray that we would have seen the same reaction, because if we wouldn't have done it, we, you know, God.
But there's nothing... the Arsene Wenger chant, to the trouble is we just get so, you know, used to it and thick-skinned to it. And then just occasionally, I'm sure we're all the same, you know, you'll be sitting there in a game and suddenly you'll come out of the moment, come out of the game and just sit there as a sort of, you know, almost a sort of alien looking from the outside and hear, you know, 30,000 people sing something about Arsene Wenger. And you'll just think... Wow, how have I been sitting there for the last 3 minutes, not appalled, outraged? Why am I not walking out of my seat? It's just staggeringly offensive to behold. And say, so, you know, that's just why I been hanging around for too long to think that, despite all the moving words that have been written, that anything's going to change.
Now, obviously, the fans in the stadium experienced it one way, but you know, millions more, the majority of people, went through this moment via radio or via television. We all say it's a difficult job, what to say, and so on. I would never want to be in that position. Ben, what did you make of the way it was covered, and what information to relate? And
it's very difficult because you don't want to be intrusive. You want to respect what's going on. You want to keep people informed. To be honest, I thought the way it was handled was a credit to the, you know, to the broadcasters who were there and to the newspaper business today and yesterday. I think it's been handled with sensitivity, with emotion, and I'm proud to be, you know, part of an industry that has dealt with this in the way it has. I think
Lansley, do you share Ben's pride in the way that he's covered this incident?
Yeah, I do. It's been quite dignified, isn't it? Really. And so difficult to have dealt with it like that. In, you know, the amount of words Gary Jacobs had to turn over, for example, for our paper, I'm sure others are the same, over such a sensitive issue. So, well played.
Dicko, this will, and again, I mentioned before, I'm loath to bring this up because, again, we don't have all the facts and. You know, we have to respect that there's a young man who's fighting for his life right now. But as we record this, but people are going to draw parallels. I mean, we're going to talk about, you know, what more could have been done. What could have been done? People don't understand how a young fit athlete can happen. I appreciate we're not doctors, we don't know what happened. But I was wondering if I just get you on this idea that stuff like this kind of reminds us of our lack of permanence, and how, you know, leaving aside whatever medical issues that there may or may not have been, you know, youth is no guarantee of anything, really.
No, I thought some part of the coverage has been interesting this morning, just about the health screening and what, as you say, what more could have been done in terms of sort of prevention. It does seem the PFA have done more than I'd realise actually in terms of ECG tests. And clearly, the sort of on-site medical care was it seems to have been as good as it possibly could have been. So, everyone will in authority will ask questions about what can be learned. But certainly the sort of initial view of this seems to have been that everything that could have been done was done. And this really was just an awful, awful, unseeable, health problem this was just a freakish occurrence.
Needless to say, if you believe in a higher power, then I think undoubtedly right now, Fabrice Muamba and his loved ones are in your prayers, and if you don't, then. He'll still be very much in your thoughts. I think he's in all our thoughts. Time now for some quick hits. Now, it took him more than 24 hours, but Fernando Torres has finally scored twice, in fact, as Chelsea pummel Leicester 5-2. Dicko, can he be the added value for Robbie Di Matteo's Chelsea in their hunt for the Champions League, FA Cup, and fourth place, which would be Di Matteo's personal treble, I guess?
Well, exactly. AVB goes and Chelsea start winning, and even Torres starts scoring. I thought he looked a bit sharp when he came on the previous game as well. So yeah, maybe somehow some little corner has been turned in his mind, and he's feeling better about life. I think we all want to see it because he has a talent, and we want to see him use that talent.
Maybe the simple answer is if you get Swiss Italian managers with advanced business degrees, then things start working out, even for your star striker. Stéphane Mignolet brought back memories of Jim Montgomery with some of his saves in Sunderland's 1-1 draw at Everton. Ben, you were there. Why is this guy so inconsistent? And does his performance suggest Everton maybe deserved it a little more?
I think his inconsistency is probably down to his age. He's only 23. He's still very much learning the game. Pulls off some fantastic saves. 1 minute, makes mistakes the next. I think as he matures, hopefully those mistakes will disappear and we'll just know him as the fantastic shot stopper that he is. He was fantastic, and Everton probably deserved to win the game. But Sunderland, they stuck in there and in the end, probably worthy as well of a replay.
Swansea win 3-0 at Fulham, and I think it's safe to say are going to stay up. Lansley, easy question for you. Could Brendan Rodgers have done this at another club since he's been at other clubs and not done it? Or is there something in the Swans' philosophy that really allowed him to flourish?
There has been a certain freedom with which he's been able to go into it, and of course getting up through the playoffs seems like a bonus. He's made the most of everything. He's bought well. I think the signings of Danny Graham and Michel Vorm have been as important as the fantastic, skillful midfielders he's got in the middle. Ashley Williams and Stephen Cork are happy to take the ball at centre-half, so it keeps things moving from the back. Could he have done it in another club? Well, he didn't in short spells at Watford and Reading, but it was always his intention. He's only been a success for 18 months, though. Let's just keep perspective on this.
That is a very good point. Like Swansea, Wigan also play pretty football, but they're just not very good. Paul Scharner, who's one of my all-time favorite, not just footballers, but people in the universe, and of course used to play for Wigan and is now at West Brom, he commented after their 1-1 draw. He said that his old club are like an animal who is dying. It tries everything to stay alive, but you can see why they're bottom of the table. They can't score, and they always concede. Do you agree with Herr Scharner's brutal assessment, Dicko? And what can Martinez do? And should we hire Paul Scharner as a columnist after he retires?
I was going to say, nice poetic reading there.
And he wears glasses too, by the way, so he's really clever.
What can Martinez do? You can ring up Randy Lerner and say, look, you know when we didn't quite sort that job out last time, any chance of reviving it, because you're still in a bit of trouble too. He can try and hypnotise DeSanto and sort of convince him he's Pelé, but apart from that, all he can do is pray, because I think they're playing pretty much most of the top four in the next month. So sadly, I think they're doomed, which is a shame, because Martinez is a bright manager, and yeah, I think he might be regretting that no to Aston Villa after all.
Is it so? Do we blame Whelan then, if it's not Martinez's fault? Come on, Whelan. Can we blame Dave Whelan then, please?
What, for which bit?
For Wigan going down.
Do you want to blame Dave Whelan?
Can we?
Gab, quick hit. Do you blame Dave Whelan for going down?
I'm asking you if I can. I'm asking for your permission.
You can blame who you like.
All right, there you go. Answers on Twitter. After that draw with Sunderland, Davey Moyes pointed out that it has been nearly two decades since his club won a trophy and lamented the closed shop nature of the league and the gap between the haves and the have-nots. Ben, it strikes me that a few years ago, we were all talking about this and tearing our hair out. I see you've already torn your hair out.
Thank you.
But now he's just sort of come to accept it, and nobody talks about this anymore. Nobody talks about the disparity in wage bills and transfer budgets and whatever. I'm assuming like we've just moved on from this, and this battle is lost forever, right?
I think there's a certain acceptance that, you know, the status quo is probably going to stay as it is for some time. It's hard to see how it won't. The magical words financial fair play have been paraded as some kind of rescue package, but I can't see that changing many things. I mean, as far as it being a closed shop, you know, Birmingham won the League Cup last season. Cardiff went pretty bloody close this season. Everton have been in an FA Cup final.
Sorry, where the League Cup? I mean, come on.
Yeah, we're talking about trophies as opposed, he was talking about trophies being a closed shop as opposed to the league title. I think the league title is a closed shop unless you're Manchester City. I think trophies, you can get lucky and pinch one. You know, football is a closed shop. I don't see it opening anytime soon.
I think the Johnson Paints Trophy is coming up. Newcastle United win again 1-0 over Norwich, and they keep their hopes for the top four intact. Lansley, what percent chance do you give them? And should we be placing Alan Pardew alongside Redknapp, Rogers, and the other familiar names as a candidate for Manager of the Year?
Well, first of all, I would give them a smallish chance, a sort of 15% chance of top four, but a very good chance of Europa League qualification. They've got Man City, they've got Liverpool, they've got Chelsea to play. They're one of those overachieving teams at the moment, so fair play to them. As for candidates for Manager of the Year, definitely. I think he's done a fantastic job there, the way he's turned it about. And after all, he did a very good job at West Ham, at Reading, at Southampton. He bought Ricky Lambert. So, yeah, very good contender.
But he's not going to win it, is he? Because, unfortunately, a lot of people in the media don't like him, right?
Is that the case?
So I'm told.
Gab, one for you. Real Madrid were held to a 1-1 draw by Malaga. Their lead is down to 8 points with 11 games to go. Surely La Liga is in the bag for Jose, right?
You would certainly think so, but there is one scenario where if you imagine them, you know, after they beat up Apoel, they go and they play Bayern in some kind of epic scenario, and it just takes everything out of them. And people start pointing out that in 2003 or 4, the Real Madrid were 8 points clear at the top, admittedly was 12 games to go. But they lost the league, and there's also the head-to-head with Barcelona that's at the Camp now, so you could argue it's really 5 points, 10 games. Can you see a couple slip-ups? I'll say there's a 5% chance. That's all we've got time for this week. Now remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find news, you'll find gossip, you'll find analysis, you'll find web chats. You can also follow us all on Twitter. We're all on there. So please be in touch. Till next time, bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.